Welcome to The Squid of Despair, unscripted musings on business life, leadership, creativity, transformation, and all the myriad of other work-life events that get in the way of a good night's sleep. Hosted by David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor.
Hello, Daz.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. I'm quite excited about today's topic, I'll be honest with you.
Well, you were quite excited at the weekend, weren't you? I know, when you celebrated the coronation.
Are we going down there? Yes, yes. We have King Charles III. And yeah, we did have a bit of a fun party. And there was some dressing up involved. But that's
of course
that's
there
a
was.
Different story.
Of course there was. So I'm guessing we don't have time to go there today because I suspect our listener would like to hear more about that.
Well, I don't know whether our listener like that or not, really. There was a party, there was a theme, red, white and blue, and there was lots of fancy dress outfits that were quite spectacular, and you know, there was some drinking. So hey ho.
Okay, yeah, you're right. We probably should leave it there.
Well, it's not like coronations come around very often, you know, certainly not in our lifetime anyway.
No, that's true. That's true. So do I get to ask the question?
You get to ask the question.
All right, Peter. So, yeah, I've been looking forward to this too. So what's the squid of the day?
Well, Daz, this episode topic begins with an A, but it's not the one you might have been expecting.
Oh, I was thinking that you were going to take us down an AI path today.
Not yet. This one's still hanging out there, I feel. But no, I'm going to take you down the path of adoption. And no, I don't want you to adopt me. It's all too late for that now. I'll be honest, listener, or listeners, possibly. I'm being a bit sneaky here because I don't know if we've mentioned that before, but I occasionally write a book, and I'm writing a brand new book right now, which is all about what I feel is the kind of the new model of PMOs, project management offices. And Daz has agreed to write a chapter on adoption. So what I'm doing here, quite sneakily, is I'm kind of getting primed to actually write that chapter for me in the very near future. So that's why I've gone for adoption.
You know, I'd forgotten that.
Oh, there's a commitment. I've got it in writing.
A good topic, Peter, because it's very appropriate for what we spend our lives doing, isn't it?
It is. So I thought I'd throw some initial thoughts out there and then we'll start the kind of conversation. So I guess for a lot of people, it's understanding the difference between, if you like, change management and change adoption. Because if you think about it, you know, change is a movement from current state to future state, and there's some kind of transition that happens in the middle there. And, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about managing change and through these phases. It's kind of a lot of what project management is all about. It's managing the change. But there's another part to it, which is around change adoption. And it's all about, you know, not just managing the change, but because you can't force people to change. It's a matter of driving an imperative to adopt change and make that kind of transformation a core aspect of an organization. If you're thinking about big transformational stuff that's going on, which is kind of our world right now. So yeah, change adoption is kind of critical for actually optimizing the impact for new initiatives, strategic objectives, motivation of the organization, encouraging differentiated results, all of those sort of things. And so, yeah, I thought it could be a really interesting kind of conversation, really. So,
yeah, it's subtle as well, isn't it? Because I'm going to ask you to define it in a minute, actually, because you sneakily compared it to change management, which, you know, I'd like you to sort of perhaps just clarify what you mean by, because it does have different meanings in the English language, and so I think we should define what you mean by that. But I would agree with you that, you know, for all the technology improvements and opportunities that are extended by evolving into a future state, at the end of the day it comes down to people basically wanting to do the new thing. And so without adoption, it's all a waste of time, isn't it? So
it's probably
the most overlooked part of change, in the sense that you can get everything right and deploy a perfect solution to a problem, but if it's not adapted, it's not going to work.
No. I came up with an example in my own life. So in many ways, I'm very progressive, but I'm also a bit of a digital dinosaur. So there are certain members of my team who are desperate for us to work in a completely different way, using the kind of collaborative tools, the kind of team stuff and all the rest of it. So I, the way I'm kind of explaining this is I have been managed through change into what it is that that part of the team, certainly, or the majority of people actually of my team, want to work. But it's not natural to me. And on that basis, I'd say, the change has been managed in, and I try very hard to perform and work in that way, but I naturally regress rapidly to email, which I am, I feel, phenomenally fast on and phenomenally accurate on. And a lot of my team don't understand that. So if you like, the change has been managed, but I haven't completely as yet adopted the change. And I do go back to my old behavior quite rapidly.
So what would you say are, I mean, taking that example perhaps, well, what are the factors that cause people to be resistant to change or to not adopt change? What are some of the factors you think that are at play there in your example?
Well, I think there's kind of comfort with the status quo is probably where I kind of start off with. I'm very happy and I think I'm incredibly efficient in the way I work, but it doesn't necessarily fit the way other people work. So, I just prefer to work in the way I've always worked, and that is positive and productive as far as I'm concerned. To learn a new way and to stop, unlearn the old ways, I guess is part of this as well, is it's very disruptive actually to kind of, I feel my performance because I'm quite clunky on the other side of the world, in the sense of the kind of digital world
Well,
anyway.
you said it, Peter. You heard it here first, listener.
All right, I'm
You're
in it. I am.
not telling me you're unaligned, are you, Peter?
Oh, behave, behave. Are we going to throw ourselves back to episode number one? And oh, so I think I, all right, I'm going to go with comfort for the status quo as definitely one point. I think perhaps there is, well, I guess there's always changes. Fear of the unknown, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I understand those comments. You've talked about your discomfort with change. You've talked about, maybe the fear of the unknown. I mean, this isn't the case, but I mean, there are factors to do with, sometimes change requires people to either unlearn something or learn something, and they're unable to do it. I mean,
Yeah, that's true.
there's a if you look at the use of technology in different generations, how at some point, the generations actually struggle to understand the technology of the previous generation or the past generation to the extent that they're unable to learn or perhaps unwilling to learn would be perhaps slightly better. And that whole point about being disruptive, about wanting, I suppose that's fear of change, isn't it? About not wanting to
I think it's a fear of
reduce.
change. You kind of drifted into perhaps, lack of skills or knowledge or capability or belief that they can't learn.
And it's interesting in the sense, in the example you use, you've got authority in this position and yet you've acquiesced to the team's request. So you're obviously seeing something there that causes you to understand there is a benefit from this.
Well, they tell me there's a benefit from it. Personally, I think I'm just as efficient without it. But I'm going with the majority in this area, absolutely. And I'm going to call you out because I don't think I have a, I don't think I'm generally resistant to change or have a fear of change. My life has been very changeable. So
Right.
but in this particular area, I guess I found my own way of being what I feel very, very efficient. And I need to learn that that may not be efficient for a larger team.
Well, in this case, this example, you are in a team, aren't you? And the team are telling you that if you carry on working the way you're working, it actually holds them back. And so, are you perhaps taking one for the team here in the sense that you understand that the need of the many is bigger than the need of the one, even though the one in this case is you.
I know. I think I think the word you're looking for is noble here. And going back to
No,
resistance, going back to resistance, I think there's also there's got to be a trust issue here, isn't there? When change is thrust upon people, there's a lot of cynicism in the world in general, but a lot of cynicism in business, I'd say. Oh God, another one of those corporate initiatives, another transformation, another major change. What's in it for me? Nothing at all, apart from extra hard work or something. There's got to be that to it.
Yeah, well, I think You said it, didn't you? I think the what's in it for me description of the results of the change is a very important factor in terms of communicating why you're doing it. And maybe in your example, the team hadn't given that to you, so you've seen no benefit whatsoever in changing your archaic working practices.
Okay, fine. I did say dinosaurs, didn't I? So you're using the,
So I mean, but that's a thing, isn't it, in change management, that you communicate in the voice of the listener, in the sense that you try and put the requirements to change in a context that makes sense for someone that's having to affect that change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's another one, which is, you touched on the fact that we will get to talk about AI at some point in the very near future. But and that's, what's the big worry about with the AI? It is, if you like, the impact on people that, this particular change could completely negate the need for the, for people, for roles, for responsibility, for whatever. And I think any change has that potential to worry people that the end result might be that their lives are fundamentally different, and there is nothing in it for them.
Yeah, and there's that dynamic, isn't there, which we see a lot in our world, where the benefit actually is not at the level of the individual that's being affected by it. And so you've got a change that is sort of, let's say, globally, or let's say at a macro level, deemed to be advantageous for the organization, or for the group, or for the objective, for the project. But at an individual level, it's a truism, isn't it, that actually individuals may well be negatively impacted by it. And so I think there's an honesty that's required here associated with adoption, which is that it's true that not everyone will benefit from change. There's a, you can argue, you take a situation where perhaps an organization is making a change for it to be more profitable, and perhaps that change results in a group of the people within the organization not being required anymore, and that's where the increased profitability comes from, by the reduction in costs. So the bigger truth is that without that reduction in costs, perhaps an organization won't continue, and so there's a much larger population of people that actually may not be gainfully employed in the future if this change isn't put into place. I mean, I'm exaggerating for effect, but that's often true on a transformation, isn't it, that there is a subset of the population that this is not going to benefit at all.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the other resistance I've seen is, particularly with the big programs of transformation, is that there's usually some kind of exciting, buzzy, rah-rah kickoff celebration. We're going to go through a major change, etc. But the reality is, it is so distant in its impact on people that they kind of like, well, it's actually nothing to do with me, and maybe it will be something to do with me one day, but I really don't have to worry about it. I'm just going to get on with life. And so, there's kind of an area of, if you like, the kind of communication, but also, kind of why the change is necessary and when the change will impact at all levels.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's very important, isn't it, to make sure that a population understands the relevance of the change. So it's not just what's in it for me, which sometimes is a bit difficult for certain subsets of the population, but there's a relevance in terms of, what's the importance of me. And when you think about relevance in an organizational construct, I think there's two sides to this, which I don't know whether you wanted to go here, but there's one which is sort of, what are the benefits? And it can be individual benefits. It could be, reduction of time. You can spend more time on, more interesting work. It could be benefits in terms of, you get to keep your job because the company's going to prosper as a result of this change in the way we work. It might be a benefit in the sense that you get to do something new, or there might be promotions in it, or that you get to learn new skills. But there's also a component of relevance, which is, this is relevant to you because you're part of an organization and we're obliging you to do it. But there's a sort of an autocratic side to transformation, which I think is tricky, because I don't know whether you'd agree with this, but I think in my working life, if ever you've been in a position where you've got to instruct someone to do something, it never lands well, really. I think it's always much more purposeful if people willingly adopt a role, or a task, or a mission or an activity because it's a recognition that it's part of their responsibility or it's part of their job or it's part of something that they want to do because they know it needs to be done, or they want to do it because you want it to be done and they respect the fact that you've got an insight here which is important to them. But if ever you get to the point of actually having to dictate an action that someone doesn't want to do, I don't think it ever ends well.
No, I agree. And you've got to sell it. It goes back to the what's in it for me. I mean, I just remember I had a big project long before we met, actually. And there was distribution centres all over the UK I was involved in. And we were deploying a whole new system. And, you know, there was naturally the sort of people who worked at these sort of small trade-based offices, really. They're more like sort of, you know, stores with warehouses behind. They had no time for anything, really. They just wanted to get on with their job and not be bothered by anything at all. But, you know, I remember a first talk kind of went along the lines of like, well, you know, this is a wonderful new system. Look at it. It's glorious. It's fantastic. It's going to be... And they had no interest in this. And then in the end, you know, we pitched it for the fact that, you know, we could double your tea breaks based on this. Is it the efficiency of this? And they started listening to that. I'm not sure I was allowed to do that, but it certainly got their attention, if you like.
Well, but I think that's a legitimate tactic, isn't it? To, you know, it is thinking about the what's in it for me, okay, and it's something to do with looking at the transformation through the eyes of the people who are going to be affected by it. I think a very powerful position to take. I think it's about active listening, isn't it? To understand, to hear the concerns, and to find ways in which a lot of them can be addressed. Because it's often the case, isn't it, when you're in a situation that people are objecting to a transformation, there's often fear involved, and that fear often comes from the unknown. But how many times have we been in a situation where the unknown for the individual actually presents something that as leading a transformation we didn't know either?
Yeah,
and so actually it's well worth spending time there. I mean, there's a sort of a small example, perhaps not a good example, but it just came to me as we were thinking about this point. There's going to be a major road that is going to be put near the village where I live, and it's an extension of a main road, but it's changing its direction slightly, so it's coming slightly closer to the village. And there's been a lot of concern in this very small village about having heavy construction traffic coming down the village, because it's a very old village and there's, you know, beautiful old stone walls that, you know, won't survive the vibration, and they certainly won't survive a hit from a truck. And all the village turned up at a meeting, a planning meeting, to talk about the fact. And the construction organization very proudly said, oh no, don't worry about the construction traffic. The construction traffic will be routed down this particular road here, so it won't go down the village. And so we were sort of initially relieved by the fact they thought about that, and actually that wouldn't impact the village. And then we pointed out the fact that had they ever been down that road, because it was a single track highway with grass growing down the middle of it, and no one had visited. You know, they'd made the plan about this relief road being used to take the construction traffic. And they'd seen the road on the map, but it was a village road which was absolutely not capable of taking trucks. And so, you know, our fear and uncertainty, which was raised as an objection to a transformation, actually caused to be a vital bit of data for them, which they'd missed.
Oh, yeah, that's probably true. I suspect if enough trucks go down there, it would be a much bigger road by the time they finish. But yeah. Good point. I've now got this image of you standing in your smock at the end of the village with a pitchfork and warding off all these horrible construction people.
Is that your view of my village life, Peter?
Well, I know you've gone very village native. I understand that. But, how did the vegetables go in the end? This is a side here, ladies and gentlemen, listeners. I know Daz was actually working. Well, I don't know. You were shouting at vegetables last night. I spoke to you about getting them ready for some kind of show.
I wasn't shouting at vegetables. No, we have the village fete, which is as middle class and English as you might imagine it to be. And yeah, I'm growing and manning the plant stall. So if any of our listeners would like to donate any plants, I'd be grateful because they've been a bit slow to grow this year. But anyway, I think
Well,
we're getting off adoption, Peter,
no,
aren't we?
that was an intermission because it was getting quite serious, so we kind of moved on. But
Oh.
yeah, let's return. So, okay, look, you challenged me with like talking about points of resistance, if you like, or you know, the challenges against change. Well, I'm going to challenge you to go the other way then. So what do we do about it? You know, what things should we be doing in order to get people to adopt change? And obviously, I'm very interested because this is going to form part of a chapter of my new book.
Yeah, I love the way you do this, Peter, because I was going to tease you because I thought you were going to do AI and I was going to say, we're only doing this because you've written a book. So we're only doing adoption because you're going to write a book. I mean, this is great. Yeah.
My publisher reminded me there was a deadline, so I better crack on with
Okay, so sorry, your question was, what can we do about it?
Yeah, so what should we do? What's the stuff that we should be doing to negate the resistance?
Because resistance is futile. We know that, don't we?
Yeah, that's a completely different book, but it's a very, very good book. But
Good.
yeah, resistance is futile. But yeah, I mean, I know obviously the opposite, you know, whatever we said is the kind of negatives of resistance, you do the opposite. But there must be some things in your experience, in your wisdom about change adoption, to kind of get people to think differently and behave differently during this kind of a transformational period.
Yeah, I mean, I think adoption is very personal to the situation you find yourself in. You know, we've been deploying sort of enterprise software solutions throughout our life, but it is so interesting, isn't it, that adoption is one of those probably top three reasons projects fail, I would think. I mean, I'm plucking that out of the air, but I would
No,
think that's
I think that's a
probably,
very fair assessment.
yeah, I mean, it's up there with bad data and lack of sponsorship, isn't it? I think is sort of probably the big three. And so I think you've got to spend way more time thinking about adoption than you would ordinarily think you'd have to. So I think people do plan well. They you know, they prepare their organizations for change. They communicate what's going to happen. But I think adoption is a phase of a deployment or an implementation. Often happens after a go live, doesn't it? It's often, if you look at it, you know, look at the software world where you have a project that gets designed, it gets implemented, it gets tested, and then it goes live. Very often from an executive point of view, that's deemed to be the end of it, you know, because you've got a new technical solution, you've got new processes, and the organization's up and running. I actually think that for technology change, that's where the hard work starts, because that's where adoption is required, and often it's where the benefits come. You know, you don't get the benefits from these sort of changes the moment you start to use them. You get them over time, and if adoption isn't rapid, then the benefits that you've perhaps proposed to justify the investment in the transformation actually are not going to come. And so there's a phase of a project after you've gone live where I think in many respects the hard work really happens, because during a project you've got a team that's well briefed, hopefully, that are very, you know, they're living and breathing it, everyone's on the same page, you all know why you're doing it, you've got a consensus from an executive team through to the end users, perhaps, that are being co-opted onto the project to make it work. So everyone is very, very, very clear about the outcomes. I think when you get into a mode of adoption, I think that all that energy and momentum often dissipates, and you've got frontline users, if I can describe it in that way, dealing with the challenges of things not working the way they did before. And then actually, perhaps things not working properly anyway because something's been missed. So I think it warrants as much time as can be given to it as part of a project plan. Focus on adoption to start with, I would suggest. Does that resonate with you?
It does resonate with me, and it's you know, again, thinking about it, it's an interesting one. You know, kind of, you know, again, in our history, our experience, you know, we've done many transformations of new technology going in. It's always that, do you go big bang? Do you go a kind of parallel period? How do we get people to come off old systems onto new systems? It's quite challenging to do that. And in fact, we got one in my world coming up where we're kind of moving across to a new way of overseeing or managing, governing our projects. And, we know that we're gonna ask our project managers to live in two worlds for a period of time. We don't know how long that is, but it's like, the old way of working and the new way of working, and adoption is going to be quite fun during that period of time. And I think the other thing is, nothing stays still. I'm going to go back to that company I talked about. I convinced them that I could double their coffee breaks or tea breaks. The other advantage I had was the old system was incredibly slow, and so it was very easy to demonstrate. But the problem I found was there were 40 of these depots that had to be rolled out, and the bit I completely and the rest of my team completely missed was that when we got to halfway point, the old system became very, very responsive because we're taking people off it. And so that advantage I had disappeared completely. So, I had to change tactics again on that one.
Yeah, well, you often see that, don't you, with implementation of new technology, which perhaps at a macro level benefits an organization or a department, but at an individual level, perhaps it's a little bit harder to do. We talked about this during the Global podcast, didn't we, that actually there's a benefit of standardization for the organization as a whole, but at the at the front line, an individual actually has to work harder to do their job because the standardized system actually isn't quite as customized is the wrong word, but it's not quite as easy to handle as their previous system. And so you often find that dislocation, don't you, between what's good for the organization against what's good for the individual. And And then, often the old system, which is being replaced, is looked upon very favorably. All its faults are forgotten about because of the new problems. I would think, if you accept the premise that you've got to spend, as much time on the adoption, let us say, as you plan on the project itself, I think that says then you've got to manage adoption. You've got to have a perspective on elements of what is adoption. And just top of my head, I think there's three things I was thinking about there. One is there's an operational side of adoption, so you can mechanistically manage adoption, can't you? You can measure how many people are using the new functionality or who are logging on or using the new process, so you can count things to recognize whether new processes, systems or techniques are being used. So I think there's an operational management of adoption, which is mechanistic, but it is about control, actually. It's about ensuring that what you wanted to have happened is happening. So there's something there, isn't there?
Yep.
There's something about measuring the benefits of adoption, which go back to the value proposition that caused you to do this transformation in the first place. And that's the one that I think is often overlooked at the end of a project where it's assumed it's going to happen. But I think you have to continue to drive adoption because actually the benefits often don't come automatically. And so there's something to do with measuring the outcomes you expected from the transformation as part of this phase. Mm-hmm. And then there's the people factor, which I probably should have said first, which I think, I think it's to do with surveys. It's to do with asking and listening about how people are getting on, because it is at that detailed frontline user, if I can just use that term, where the wheels often come off, isn't it? Where there's something unexpected that's come up that hasn't been designed into the system, and so it's vital that there's a conduit back through the organization to deal with those myriad of challenges that happened during early adoption, so that there's got to be access to experts, there's got to be access to frequently asked questions, to help, to training. There's a whole slew of operational things that need to be made available to individuals, I think, to support them during a a transformation to help adoption.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think I agree with all that. And I think if you talk about measuring the benefits, I think you've got to track it. I mean, you know, an organization goes through change for some purpose. But I think you go back down again, it's kind of, it talks to the people side of things and the what's in it for me. It's like, how can you track any, you know, benefits at multiple levels, I think, you know, in track, you know, understand if this change is not helping or improve certain people's lives, as opposed to it is helping in other ways. I mean, I think it's really just the kind of multi-level assessment of benefits is important.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, we talked about training there and we haven't talked enough about that, I don't think. I'm wondering whether that's a very overlooked component of these sort of transformations where adoption at the heart comes out of, you know, as you said, negating those negative factors. So giving people comfort, addressing the fear, speaking to challenges of people unable to learn and dealing with disruption. And, you know, is training that sort of silver bullet? Is that the panacea perhaps that really is the one thing that organizations can do to support adoption is to provide excellent training?
Well, I think what, you know, I challenge what do we mean by excellent training there? Because I think organizations are pretty good. You know, if we're thinking again, let's stick with the, you know, our world, you know, new technology, new systems. To train in it is relatively straightforward. You know, you do A, you do B, you do C, you get these results, et cetera. You can run this report, whatever. I mean, and typically you're training people in a subset of it because it's all about their part of the job. But I think what's often missed is the why. You know, why has this changed? What is the overall benefit to it? Why does this have to be different? Why is this temporarily, hopefully, disrupting your job and your life to move across and asking you to do extra effort during a period of time to learn the new system and to get to grips with it, so it becomes your natural home for working? I think that is often missed, and it's probably one of the reasons that there are challenges out there.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, going back to artificial intelligence and the way that's transforming so many different worlds, it was quite interesting, I think, with some of the transformation we're really seeing through that technology is actually, you know, the end results are not actually predictable. And so, you know, in terms of outcomes, the outcomes, I think, probably to take the benefit of artificial intelligence, and we'll come on to this on another podcast, but is actually not to define the end goal precisely. I think that's probably where we're going to get benefits from that sort of application of that sort of technology. I mean, we're going to have guide rails. And so just interesting how we, you know, I think adoption of artificial intelligence has a different dynamic to the adoption of a piece of technology that's automating a process or optimizing workflows or producing an enhanced transactional outcome. I think AI has a very different dynamic, which is actually open-ended, which I think is why there's a lot of fear about it, actually.
I think you're probably right there. Okay. Well, I think, as I said, I'm quite excited about this. I'm looking forward to reading your great thoughts on this because, you know, when I did a little bit, my usual little bit of minimal research, it's, it's very easy to find a whole bunch of stuff around change management, but it's not so easy to find stuff about change adoption. Change management is all about communicating a change, create a sense of urgency, developing a plan, identifying resistance, provide and train support. It is part of it, absolutely. Monitoring progress and celebrating success. And, you know, that's fairly typical stuff, isn't it? You know, how do you make this change stick? How do you make it show results? And, you know, how do you continue to kind of move on from there? So there's a lot in that out there, but change adoption, not so much really. Maybe you think about writing the book after this chapter you got to write.
How many words do you want from me, Peter, in this chapter?
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to conclude with a public demand. Now, I can send you a transcript to this podcast. That'll probably help you. I mean, if anything else. I'd like somewhere around about 2,500 words, something like that, by mid-June.
Oh, for goodness sake. Okay. Before, because I don't think our reader's got to work yet, before we close, so one technique, you know, one of my future topics is going to be about creativity, because, you know, have I told you about the Creative Cookbook, Peter?
Yes, you have mentioned the Creative Cookbook.
is to take a subject like this and look at it from a completely different perspective to see whether it gives you new insights. And so here's a question for you, looking at adoption from a different perspective. Can you give me an example of adoption that isn't in the field that we've been talking about, you know, technology transformations? Can you think of something in the human sphere where adoption is an appropriate word to use? And I don't, so there we go. Give me an example of adoption that's non-technology project related.
Oh, that's mean. That's really mean. It's going to be a really awkward. So how long does our listener take to get to work? How long can I go?
Yeah, they're there now. So maybe you can think about that. And you could send that to me to help me think about how to write 2,500 words for you.
Okay. I'll go off ChatGPT. Interesting. Oh, we're all right. I accept that challenge.
Well, I think it comes down to your definition of adoption, actually. Mm-hmm. We had a very narrow definition of adoption for this podcast, which I think was appropriate. Otherwise, we'd have gone on for even longer than we've gone on, and that would be very tedious for our listeners. But I think there's a generic generic definition of adoption which might help us think about this topic in order to get 2,500 words out of it.
Okay. Well, I've got a lot of faith in you of actually producing 2,500 words easily. But I'll take the challenge. I'll think about it. I'll come back to you, and I'll send you the show notes as well. It might help you as a kind of prompt you.
All right. And can you just run it past ChatGPT to it so I don't have to write anything?
No. It gets checked.
I'm not sure how they can do that, actually, but
there's already some technology that can identify patterns of AI produced text. So you've got to be careful there.
Interesting.
Yeah,
well, no, it's a good one, Peter. Thank you. I will think about adoption, and I will do my homework by the middle of June, and
thank you.
I look forward to hearing from you what other examples of adoption so I can work on that as well.
Thank you for that challenge. There's something about you. I always walk away with some kind of action after I talk to you. It was very frustrating for the last goodness knows how many years. But thank you, Daz. It's been great.
Thanks, Peter. Bye bye.
You've been listening to an unusual podcast from David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor. More information can be found at www.squidofdespair.com.